It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many items have been back-ordered or sold out in the last few months, including sewing machines. We'll talk to a local sewing instructor about the new demand. First, if you're really into healthy cooking and eating, you might be familiar with our next guest. Aaron Clark is a Milwaukee resident and the founder of the blog Well Plated with Aaron. The gist is healthy recipes that are easy to follow, use common ingredients, are affordable, and taste good. She's out now with a new cookbook. There's lots of advicey stuff in it, too, like how to instantly become a better cook, some must-have kitchen tools, pantry staples, and more. It's called The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Aaron Clark joins us now for Food Friday. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
How did you first get into cooking, Aaron?
Well, my love of cooking started in the dessert category. I grew up baking with my grandmothers in Wichita, Kansas, and every week during the summer, my Grammy would pick us up, bring us over to her house, and she would have picked out a different dessert recipe. I credit her with my sweet tooth. And we would make it together, and at that moment, I really fell in love with being in the kitchen, not only for the process, but also because I just really enjoyed the memories and the sense of community that I've always experienced with my family there. So fast forward to college, I make a pretty mean cake. But when I graduated, it turns out that you can't live on grandma's brownies and cookies the way that I think we all probably wish that we could. So I realized I'm probably going to have to learn how to cook something else for myself. So I went to the library, checked out a big stack of cookbooks. I started going to farmers markets. I still had a lot of student loans at this time, so budget was definitely a consideration for me. And I was also becoming more mindful about how I could eat more nutritiously. So pair that with this very classic Midwestern upbringing where, you know, the vegetables that were the star of the show in my family were corn and potatoes, or they came out of a can. And I found myself really enjoying playing around in the kitchen, creating lighter versions of the comforting dishes that I had enjoyed. And all along while this was happening, I've always loved writing. A friend of mine who knew that I really enjoyed writing and who knew I enjoyed cooking suggested that I start a food blog. Now, this is 2012, and while food blogs are a fairly popular commodity now, back then I have this vivid memory of Googling what is a food blog, and I pulled it up, seemed like people were posting some photos and recipes. I had a flip phone with a camera on it, so I thought, hey, I can do this too. And the very first recipe that I posted was a lightened up version of the green chili chicken enchiladas that my Grammy makes for us every Christmas. I thought that I was just kind of putting this out in the universe and nobody was going to click on it. But lo and behold, a few days later, a girlfriend of mine from high school messaged me to say that they'd made the enchiladas, loved them. Did I have any more recipes? And I thought, well, I guess I do. And now we can fast forward almost 10 years and 1,400 recipes later. And I still love the feeling of sharing recipes and having people make them as much today as I did back then.
We'll check out a couple of the recipes you shared with us in just a couple minutes. But also in your cookbook, you share, you know, kind of a best of lists of different kinds of advice. One is some easy ways to add a little extra healthiness, sneak in a little extra good stuff to our food to make it healthier. What are a couple of your either throw-ins or substitutions that you keep going back to?
This is so key for me when it comes to cooking healthy food in general, because we all want to eat food that tastes great. So rather than having to start from scratch, I'm a big believer in making small changes. Some of those would include where you might typically make spaghetti with white regular pasta noodles. Try a whole grain noodle. I bet it will surprise you, and you're going to get more fiber and nutrients in your diet than you would with the white pasta. Another signature swap of mine is to use plain non-fat Greek yogurt in situations that would typically call for sour cream. It has that same delicious creaminess, that light tang, but it's really high in protein and is much more nutritionally valuable than sour cream. So just really looking for not I don't think you necessarily need to overhaul your cooking. They're just small changes that you can make here and there that make a big impact in the long term.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Erin Clark. Her new cookbook is The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite healthy cooking bit of advice, or do you have a question for Erin about how to make something, maybe a regular dish, a wee bit healthier? Call in at 800-642-1234. By the way, you can find some recipes that Erin has shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. And let's get into one of those now, Erin. And a regular Food Friday listeners know I look forward to winter squash season every year, one of my favorite seasonal produces in the world. One of the recipes you shared with us is a butternut squash, chicken, and wild rice casserole. It sounds great. Tell us about it.
I adore this recipe. When you think of how the feeling of comfort and warmth being wrapped up in a hug that we all crave in the fall, this recipe is that very embodiment. It's also a casserole, which I have a very deep childhood love for. I think that a number of us in Wisconsin can appreciate the sensibility of a dish where everything is all in one pan. What makes this one special is that it includes every single food group that you need. And I think that when we try to think about eating a healthy diet, something that I hear from a lot of people that is intimidating is the fact that you feel like there's so many separate things that you need to prepare. Okay, well, we need a meat. Now on this side, it's supposed to be healthy, so I'm going to have to add a vegetable over here. And before you know it, your list of things you have to cook for dinner is a mile long. A recipe like this butternut squash casserole, you have the whole grains from the wild and brown rice. We've got our vegetable from our absolutely delicious butternut squash. I love butternut squash so much too. It's one of my favorites. Yeah. You have your lean protein from the chicken. And then for a little bit of deliciousness, because healthy food should never be bland or taste like a sacrifice, you've got the dried cranberries, the Parmesan, the thyme, the pecans. You don't need a lot of those special ingredients, but when you finish a dish with them, it turns it into something from something that you feel like you have to eat or you should eat into something that you'll legitimately crave.
And the one dish philosophy here fits into something you do throughout the book. Some of your recipes, you say, are a little more long and involved when you got the time to do it. But you also pay attention to those times when people don't have a lot of the time, like kind of making your own McMuffin sandwiches at home, but having them frozen and ready to rock in the morning. Talk about the importance of having those, I got 5 minutes to make a meal kind of options.
I get it. I am a full-time food blogger and cookbook author, and I have nights where I do not want to cook or I do not have time to cook. That is the situation that we all live in. And when I approach a recipe, what is most important to me is I want it to be attainable in your kitchen and in your everyday life. And so in addition to having some of those special recipes, a few of my favorites are in the cookbook. I go into 4 unboring ways to use shredded chicken, because while it's great if you have time to cook your own chicken, and I give you ways to do that in the book, you know what? Store-bought rotisserie chicken is a fantastic tool. So I've included a few quick and easy things you can do with it. Different ways that you can top a baked sweet potato. Different things you can do with a can of chickpeas. These, when you have these simple, quick fire recipes in your arsenal, then a night when you might be tempted to call for takeout, knowing that you can pull something delicious and nutritious out in 15 minutes can be the difference in a home cooked meal versus not.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I have food allergies, and I'm on a grain-free anti-inflammatory diet. I'm also allergic to nightshade vegetables. The last one really nails me because I love tomatoes and peppers so much. But I have a couple of substitutes for people that want to go completely cereal grain-free, and some other suggestions. Instead of the whole wheat spaghetti noodles, you can buy sweet potato noodles at the Asian food store, and they take a little getting used to, but they're really, really good for you. You should eat a sweet potato every day. And the other thing I wanted to say is that quinoa is it also takes a little getting used to because it has kind of a strange texture, but it's also really good food. It's very high in protein, and you can use it as a substitute for rice or whatever.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Aaron, have you worked with things like that, things you'd put in place of grain, either because you need to, like Chris does, or because you want to, because some people like quinoa and sweet potato substitutions and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. So another really popular one, like those sweet potato noodles. Chris, my husband, and I actually really like those too. Or what? Sometimes we'll do zucchini noodles, especially in the summer where I feel like I have zucchini coming out of my ears. And for those, it's a really great way to sneak in an additional serving of vegetables without feeling like you're making a sacrifice. And something else that my husband and I will do sometimes for those who don't have dietary restrictions is you can even make spaghetti with half whole wheat noodles and half vegetable noodles. And that kind of gives you the best of both worlds for those who are able to do that.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We are talking to Erin Clark on this edition of Food Friday. She's the Milwaukee resident who blogs at Well Plated by Erin. She's got a new cookbook out. It's called The Well Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. She has shared three recipes. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday, that butternut squash and chicken dish we talked about. Coming up, we'll touch on some killer kale salad and chocolate-covered strawberry brownies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a quick, healthy, cheap dish that is a go-to in your household? Or do you find it hard to make healthy stuff that actually tastes good? Is there a pantry item you always have on hand? How about a kitchen bit of gear that you couldn't do without? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking about quick, affordable, and healthy cooking with Erin Clark, Milwaukee resident, author of the new cookbook, The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite healthy recipe that you like to make and or eat? Are there some tricks that you use to make your dishes a little healthier? Or do you have questions for our guest, maybe about substitutions, changes, things to freshen things up a little bit? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erin, let's check out another recipe you've shared with us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday. This kale salad. Now, you've got the fundamental recipe here and some variations too, which I love. Tell us about your kale salad.
First of all, I would just like to apologize to everyone who's had a terrible kale salad and who heard the words kale salad and thought, oh no, this girl is not for me. The one big tip that I can give you to make a truly killer kale salad, I meant it when I named that recipe, is to really get your hands in there and massage the kale. It breaks down its fibers and it turns it into something that a bunny would not, or that only a bunny would sniff. Into a salad that is really soft and buttery and can take on a lot of different flavors. And that once you have your kale ready to go, it can actually last in your refrigerator for several days. So it's a great thing to prep once and then enjoy all week long. So the kale starts with a base. And then from there, I have given different variations for ways you can take that same salad and create different spinoffs for the season. So I have a harvest version, we have a Mediterranean version, and a Mexican version. They all start with the same building blocks of your kale, great grain like quinoa is excellent mixed in there, some kind of beans for some protein, and then really just the fun and yummy mix-ins like cheese and nuts. And if you take, say, 40 minutes to prep a huge batch on the weekend, you'll be able to enjoy healthy lunches all week long. And I love this whole idea of just taking a single base recipe and then building on it. You can learn one technique and then enjoy it over and over again. It makes your cooking less stressful and more exciting too.
I was going to say, I love that mindset. And it's along the lines of your, four uses for shredded chicken and that kind of thing. It's learn this precise recipe and then you can replicate this precise recipe in the future. Instead, it's learn this basic thing, and then you get to do what you want with it, which I appreciate.
Exactly. And sometimes, I don't want to go to the grocery store and go shop for the one ingredient I don't have, which is why it's great to have just a really simple formula that you can then swap in and out the different things that you either have on hand or that you just personally prefer.
We heard from Kelly in Green Bay who wants to know if there's a substitution for making basil pesto Kelly says, to make it less fattening. Now, I'm thinking of basil pesto, and there's some nuts and olive oil, which I hear, I'm no nutritionologist, but I hear it's those are the good fats. That said, do you have thoughts on healthy pesto, Erin?
Well, it was Kelly, right?
Kelly, yeah.
Yeah, Kelly, you need my cookbook because you and I have extremely similar feelings about pesto. I actually have a recipe in my book for creamy basil pesto. And my trick is that I swap out some of the oil for Greek yogurt. I was not kidding when I said it was one of my favorite healthy ingredients earlier. It makes the pesto thick and creamy, but it's still really luscious and rich and far less fattening. I also sneak in some extra veggies there. Rather than doing entirely basil, I do a mix of half basil and half spinach. The spinach is so mild, you can't even taste it, and yet you're adding so much more nutritional benefit to your pesto. I have 4 containers of it in my freezer right now, and I just can't wait till the winter day when I get to pull out and enjoy it.
All right, Kelly, I hope that helps you out. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Erin Clark about her new book, The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Erin, by the way, a Milwaukee resident. Let's get to the third recipe you shared with us, Erin. Getting back to your baking days, the recipe is chocolate-covered strawberry brownies. I'll say you had me at chocolate-covered strawberry brownies. Tell us about these. They sound great.
I am a big believer that everyone should have a back pocket brownie recipe. It is a life necessity. And for me, when I'm craving a brownie, I typically was craving it about 20 minutes ago. And so when I set out to create this recipe, I was determined that I could come up with a stellar, lightning fast brownie recipe that could be made in one bowl. I absolutely hate doing dishes, hence the other reason for the large number of one pan and one pot suppers in my cookbook. I just don't want to wash dishes. And so these brownies are a stellar base. They're just nice and fudgy, a little crackly, crispy on the top. And then the suggestion that I have in the cookbook is to layer on fresh strawberries and a drizzle of chocolate. It makes them really special and memorable. But if that's not your thing, or you just are feeling like you need to dig into your brownie immediately, you can enjoy it on its own. I've included a version for topping it off with sea salt and caramel. Possibilities are really limited only by your imagination.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. And yeah, do you go with the berries of the season sometimes with that?
Oh, that is a fantastic idea. Absolutely. Earlier this summer, I did a version of these with raspberries and white chocolate. It was to die for.
Oh, that sounds so good. I love the sound of that. Hey, let's talk about equipment a little bit. I know there's one kitchen gadget that, it's a desert island pick for you. What is your essential kitchen piece of gear that you would not be left without?
I am a big believer in a really good quality chef's knife. I don't think that you need a bunch of fancy kitchen gadgets to be a great cook. Those things are fun, but I'm actually, despite being a cook for my full-time job, very much a minimalist in the kitchen. I don't need a garlic press. I'm really happy with my great chef's knife. It will make every kitchen task that much quicker and easier for you.
And then for cookware, I understand you're a big fan of your Dutch oven.
Oh, I take it to bed with me at night. No, I really do. That is an investment piece that will last a lifetime. I received mine for a wedding gift going on 9 years ago, and I have beaten it up and used it several times a week, and it serves me just as well today as it did back then.
Now, I want to go behind the scenes a little bit. You've shared a lot, hundreds of recipes on your food blog, and you've got a lot in the cookbook. What goes into testing a recipe and making sure that when you put it into written form, you have conveyed your intent and what you actually do in the kitchen?
It's once I have the concept for a recipe down, you know, say I decide I want to make a really great recipe for homemade fried rice. I will think through every single component because I'm not just walking into the kitchen, throwing it together for my husband and self and I to eat for dinner that night. I am trying to compile it so that you, your home and your kitchen can recreate it with the same success. So I plan out every ingredient to make sure that you can find it at my barometer of whether or not an ingredient will go into my cookbook is, can I find it at Pick and Save? Here, right down the road in Milwaukee. If I can't, there's no reason for me to think you can find it in your kitchen either. I'll cut it out or come up with something else that you can find. I think about the number of pots and pans you're going to get dirty. And I'm not going to ask you to measure a million different spices and get every single bowl dirty because, like we talked about, cooking dinner at all, let alone a healthy dinner, is a challenge. And so with every recipe, I try to eliminate every possible barrier to that. I meticulously write out every recipe and adjust the notes as I go along. And then I test multiple times. So for me, the most important part of writing my cookbook was that the recipes work. No matter how beautiful a cookbook looks, it won't do you any good if the recipe doesn't turn out. And so for that reason, the recipes in my book, I personally tested those brownies. I think I tested those brownies about 10 times. I have a very vivid memory of weeping into a pan of those brownies when my sister was here because they weren't just right.
Uh-oh.
In addition to testing myself, I ask close friends and family to test them for me as well, just to make sure that it turns out as well for them as it does for me.
In our last minute, you're in Wisconsin, I'm in Wisconsin. Let's talk about cheese. You are a very strong advocate of grating your own cheese as opposed to buying pre-grated. Why is it such a big difference maker?
That is one tip that every single person listening can do right now that will automatically make their food taste better. When you buy pre-packaged, pre-shredded cheese, it is typically coated with a powder-like substance to keep it from all clumping together in the bag. That substance not only dilutes the cheese's flavor, it also makes it so it doesn't melt as well. So if you've ever wondered why your cheese might not be as stretchy or as creamy, that can be a big reason. It's also a lot more affordable to buy cheese and grate it yourself off the block. I like to do it all at once, sometimes in my food processor, throw it in a plastic container, and then I can just keep it in my refrigerator and it is good to go.
Erin, that's a great piece of advice to leave us with. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Milwaukee's own Erin Clark joined us today for this edition of Food Friday. She's the creator of Well Plated by Erin. That's a blog. And her new cookbook is The Well Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. We've got three of those recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. Butternut squash chicken and wild rice casserole, three variations of her killer kale salad, and chocolate-covered strawberry brownies. Give them a shot this weekend. Let us know how it went. Coming up after the news, crafty folks around the nation put their sewing machines into action this spring when demand for face masks spiked, and now sales in sewing machines continue to go strong. We'll talk about sewing's big moment with a Wisconsin instructor. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the leader of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism about what changes her organization is calling for in that community. First, sewing machine sellers, manufacturers, and repair shops have been trying to keep up with a sudden demand for their services and products, beginning right around the time the CDC recommended masks be worn by everyone. While mask supply seems to have caught up with demand now, sewing machine waitlists continue to grow. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done some sewing yourself in the last few months? Have you experienced challenges in getting supplies? Have you gotten into sewing for the first time, picked it up again after a long pause, or have you always been into it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Denise Hullida is a sewing instructor at Madison College. She's teaching online classes now and this fall in their non-credit continuing studies program. Denise, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Denise, have you seen this surge in interest in sewing this year?
I have. I've been having a lot of my students have contacted me, and other people have reached out to them to make masks and ask how to sew them and what they can do.
And has it been hard for people to get the supplies, whether it's the machines or the materials that they need?
Both of those are very high demand. Right now, I talked with three or four of the sewing machine businesses in Madison here, and all of them say the same things. Very few entry-level machines are that they can have in stock right now because this is being affected worldwide. And the inventory is mostly shipped in to the States here, and, you know, plants were shut down, and they haven't been able to get the supply, especially of the entry-level machines that are, like, in the under $700. They have a few mid-range machines left that go up to, like, $2,000 and above, then a few more of those. But they've really had an uptick in more cleaning and repairs. Every machine seems to be taken out of an attic or a garage or somewhere, and they have one person, one of the dealers in town last week had 103 machines in for repair.
Wow.
And tune-ups, and they said as fast as they go out, they're replenished, and they can't figure out how many more can be in the attics that are being pulled out.
I wonder. Is this a story just about people wanting to make masks, or does it go beyond that?
It goes beyond that, but I have to say masks are really regenerating the need because, you know, we've been having an uptick of sewing. I've been teaching classes for 20 years, and I would say the last 10 has been an increase in people's interest. But especially right now, you know, making masks has been key for many of the people. And people are at home and have a little more time that they're able to make their own.
Let's talk about demographics. Are you seeing maybe younger people show more of an interest this year or even over those last 5-10 years or so?
Over the last 5-10 years, I have to say a lot. Well, there's more younger people. My students range from 16 years old to 95 years old. So it's quite a broad area. But yes, I have been getting more people that are younger because it's kind of skipped a generation for teaching people to sew. And I'm getting many more men as well.
Talking to Denise Hollida, sewing instructor at Madison College, talking about a big surge in interest in sewing and tough times finding some of the necessary gear, sewing machines in particular, backups for new ones and for repairs as well. Well, Denise, suppose somebody's thinking about getting into it and they're willing to wait for the starter machine to become available or the old one they found to get fixed. What are the first steps you recommend people do if they're learning it, maybe for the first time?
Well, the first time, beginning sewing class is always a great place to start because you not only learn about the machine and understand how to use the machine, but you understand the basics of construction, you know, what fabric, how you lay patterns out on it to make sure that your end product is as good as you would like it to be.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Wildflower with us in Plymouth. Wildflower, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I am a mask maker currently. I'm finishing an order that gets picked up at 4:30 today. I worked for 40 years as a costume designer. And so when this came around, I started making them to give away. But I have a very large supply of fabric. I always say my attic is insulated with fabric. So I have some very unique prints. And so people have been seeing them, and they started ordering them and paying. And being a senior citizen with no other income, it's been a nice little pocket money for me.
Well, when you've got an order for today, how big an order, how many masks are we talking about?
Today's is only 4, and this is somebody local that brought their own fabric in of lighthouses and sailboats. I believe they live in Sheboygan. Sometimes I get them an order for a dozen at a time, and they can be from all over this country because people have been seeing them on Facebook and that's how they order them.
Thanks so much for sharing that with us. And that reminds me, Denise, I've seen a lot of people getting pretty creative with masks. I think it was, at first it was whatever random scraps I have around, but people are getting pretty artistic, aren't they?
They really are, and there's so many different styles of masks that are out there. That's one thing I taught a class a week ago on face masks, and I said not all faces are created equal. I taught 3 different styles because the one I like isn't the one that my son or my husband like, you know, because they fit our faces differently. So if you don't, if you're out sewing a face mask and you're not liking how it is, go online. There's a lot of free patterns out there. Try another one, and you'll probably find one that might work better for you.
We found that in my house. One of the household members has a very large face and generally large head. That's me, of course. Let's bring on another caller now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I hope you will utilize this time to encourage mothers to start sewing their babies' diapers. I am so irritated about the immense amount of money that young mothers spend on disposable diapers, which cause for cutting down a lot of trees, using up all the space and dumps and landfills. And there were information about sewing diapers or buying cloth diapers and washing them, or buying fabric and making your own diapers. And sewing a diaper is, I mean, that's one, two, three. Please.
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. I guess moms or maybe even dads could make their own diapers, Denise.
Oh, yes, and I have to say that is one of the populations that I have in my class. I'm not going to say all of them make diapers. Some of them do. I have had some that do, but, you know, they're becoming a new parent, and they want to sew for their baby. So that is one of the things that brings people back into sewing or starting up sewing.
And it doesn't have to be diapers. What are some a good next step projects? Maybe we've mastered some of the basics, or we figured out how to do masks. What are some of the next things you would encourage people to try sewing to spread their sewing wings a little bit?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of fun things that you can do to do that. There's like a microwave bowl holder. It's always a nice thing because it's good for all generations. It's something that you can put in the microwave, have your soup in it. You put it in, and it's like a hot pad underneath it so you don't burn your hands. That's an easy one. And you learn darts in it, which is a technique. I'm always like to teach a technique with things. Then you also have maybe a pair of sweatpants or shorts. Those are an easy one. Doesn't have to fit super tight or anything. And that's another good startup project. Or there's people who are getting into quilting. Quilting is a very popular class, and that's one thing I'm going to be trying to teach online is a beginning quilting class. So that's a fun thing too.
And briefly, as we wrap up, what's it like to teach sewing online?
Well, it is definitely different. I have found I am definitely a hands-on person in the sense that when you're teaching something, you read a person's face. You can't read them online like you do in a classroom. So it has become different. But a couple of cameras and different angles, and I think we're getting it down. Every time I think it gets a little better, but you have to be pretty creative on doing sewing online.
Denise, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Denise Hullida is a sewing instructor at Madison College. She's teaching online classes now and this fall, and she joined us to talk about a demand for sewing machine supplies and other gear lately. Coming up, we'll check in with a Kenosha-based advocacy group calling for change after the shooting of Jacob Blake by police. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book about legendary escape artist Harry Houdini, who spent many of his early years here in Wisconsin. Now, on Sunday afternoon, Kenosha police officer Rustin Shesky shot Jacob Blake, a black man, 7 times in the back outside of his car. Blake survived the shooting and is still hospitalized. His family says he will likely remain paralyzed. There are many details still unknown. We'll learn more in the coming days and weeks. But we do know that Blake's shooting is one of the latest this year alone of black individuals at the hands of police. The 2020 killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor by police galvanized people across the country to call for reforms to law enforcement, and they highlighted racial inequities. In Kenosha, the protest calling for change following Blake's shooting turned fatal as 2 protesters were killed by an armed counter-protester earlier this week. Our next guest leads an advocacy group that works to address and reduce racism in her community. Adeline Green is leader of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. Adeline, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you tell us a little bit about a little bit more about your organization and what you had been doing up until this shooting?
Yes. Our organization, the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism, has actually been around for almost 24 years. It was started in 1997 under the leadership of Reverend Olin Arrington Jr., who had the vision that we could address racism through bringing community people together to celebrate differences and diversity and build upon that strength. We began having an event that we called Kenosha Kindness Week that was started in 1997 around Dr. Martin Luther King's celebration of his birthday. And we bring community players like education, religion, community-based organizations together to just talk about Dr. King's message of tolerance and acceptance and getting together and being treating each other like human beings. Our organization also, during the course of time, has put together an event that we call Courageous Conversations. And with those courageous conversations, we really hone in on issues of race, especially systemic and institutional racism in various institutions like education, like health care, like incarceration, the legal system, and other things. So we've been doing this for a long time, hoping that by bringing the community together and just having a conversation about these various issues, people could have a higher sense of awareness about how racism permeates all of our institutions and impacts many of us disproportionately. So in a nutshell, that's what the Coalition for Dismantling Racism has been doing over the course of time.
What went through your head when you saw now this latest shooting? You know, we've seen them in Minneapolis and Louisville and elsewhere, and the latest on the list was your own city of Kenosha.
It was unreal, unbelievable, because even though we as the coalition have been doing the work that we've been doing, we thought our choir was getting bigger, that more people were paying attention, that more people were attending our forums and listening and getting a better understanding of racism. And so for this tragedy to happen in our own community, it was just a shock. It was a shock to everyone, and it just kind of took us back in terms of, you know, what else can we do? What more can we do to bring out the evils of racism and how it could hit any community? I did not expect it to hit Kenosha in the way that it did, but it can happen anywhere. And so it's a wake-up call for our country and our community that racism is not absent from any community.
I want to give a listen to Jacob Blake's sister, Letitia Weideman, speaking for the family earlier this week. Here she is.
So many people have reached out to me telling me they're sorry that this happened to my family. Well, don't be sorry, because this has been happening to my family for a long time, longer than I can account for. It happened to Emmett Till. Mm. Emmett Till is my family. Mm. Philando, Mike Brown, mm. Sandra. This has been happening to my family, and I've shed tears for every single one of these people that it's happened to. Mm. This is nothing new. I'm not sad. I'm not sorry. I'm angry. Mm. And I'm tired. Mm. I haven't cried one time. I stopped crying years ago. Mm. I am numb.
And she mentioned Emmett Till today, the 65th anniversary of the brutal murder of Emmett Till. The anger, the tired, the numbness. Can you talk about those feelings, Adeline?
She's absolutely right. She hit the nail on the head. Those of us in the Black community are tired. We are exhausted. We experience racism on a regular basis. I have a son, and of course he's Black like me, and he's been stopped by the police. I can't tell you how many times for what appear to be bogus reasons. This happens so much in the Black community. My husband has been stopped. I've read countless accounts of Black people who've been stopped by the police, and the statistics on arrests for Black men in particular, the incarceration rates for Black men in Wisconsin is just incredible. And part of that has to do with the police relationships with communities of color, in particular Black communities. And so people have to face up to the fact that this is an issue across the country, but particularly in Wisconsin, it is a big issue.
Talking to Adeline Green, leader of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. Adeline, what are you hoping comes out of this? What reforms are you hoping to see locally, statewide, whatever level?
I'm hoping the relationships between law enforcement and the community change. I'm hoping that people in law enforcement de-escalate situations rather than going in there with a militaristic viewpoint, particularly when they approach Black suspects, Black people in general, because I do believe that they see things through a racial lens. They see us as more aggressive, that we are more suspicious, and you know that attitude has to change for anything to change before we can start talking about policies. I don't know that even training will remedy this situation, because people's hearts and minds have to change in terms of how we view each other as human beings.
On your group's Facebook page, you have recommended that people observe the curfew. What are you hoping to see from protests in Kenosha and around the nation in the days to come?
I'm hoping that these protests bring attention and continue to bring attention to the fact that racism is real. Racism exists, and it has for more than 400 years, and you can't keep brushing this under the rug and thinking it's going to go away, because eventually it's going to erupt in your community. It happened here in Kenosha, one of the greatest places, I think, to live. However, there are some underlying issues here as well, and if you don't address them, if you don't bring the racism out in the open and come up with solutions as a community, this is going to continue to happen.
We talk about these things a lot after a dramatic moment like this weekend in Kenosha. What do you think needs to happen to have the conversation going on all the time, not just after a tragic event like this?
Well, I think people need to come to the table when invited, and not just organizations like our anti-racism organization, but the police departments, the health departments, you know, the legal teams, the incarceration and parole people. They need to be asking the community to come to them with solutions, with issues, because there are issues out there, and really pay attention to what the issues are, because they are different for different communities. The African-American community does not view the police department very well. We don't view them as our friends and servants for us. They're viewed as somebody that is going to harm us, and that relationship needs to change before anything can change. Those relationships, there have to be conversations, and it can't be just the advocacy, the anti-racist group that has those conversations with people who agree with them. We have to bring others to the table, those who don't believe that racism is the cause for some of these things happening. But that's what I think needs to happen.
In our last 30 seconds or so, do you feel any sense of optimism that this time things could get at least a little better?
I felt optimism after George Floyd, when I saw all the rainbow of people out there protesting on his behalf. I was just ecstatic. And now this has deflated me happening in my community. I'm still hopeful, but a little bit of my hope has dissipated with this incident.
Adeline, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Adeline Green is the leader of the Kenosha Coalition for Dismantling Racism. She joined us today to talk about the work her organization is doing to address racism in the Kenosha community and what she hopes comes out of the protests following the police shooting of Jacob Blake in that city. you can follow the ongoing developments in this story. A lot of things still being figured out and up in the air. You can watch for ongoing reporting at WPR.org/news and look at past and upcoming features over at wiscontext.org. That's wiscontext.org. There are some new changes coming here on the Ideas Network, and they start next Monday. You can get a full rundown over at WPR.org/fall2020. Here are some of the highlights of our weekday calendar. 1A, which you usually hear Monday through Thursday before Central Time, is now going to air at their live time. That's 9 to 11 a.m. And you can hear a special 1A recap hour at 6 p.m. That's going to replace some of the time that we've been repeating Central Time. Ah, you ask, what happens from 1 to 3 on weekdays then? Science Friday fans, don't worry. Science Friday is still going to be Science Friday. Monday through Thursday, we'll have a familiar program from 1 to 2 that's On Point in their new streamlined one-hour version. Then a new show for us, The Takeaway. You can hear interviews with the hosts of 1A and The Takeaway. They aired this week on Central Time, and you can find those in our archives at WPR.org/Central Time. The Morning Show, Larry Mueller, Chapter a Day, and Central Time all stick around. I will be off next week with Keely Boltina and Judith Sears-Poisson filling in for me, but I will still, after that, be hosting Central Time, so don't panic or celebrate when you don't hear me on the air. Again, find more info at WPR.org/fall2020. You can share your thoughts and questions about these changes with our audience services department at listener@WPR.org or 800-747-7444. This is Central Time.